This is The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I'm on the line with Lindsay Bench, who's spokesperson for the Utah Pumpkin Growers. And if you'll recall, we've had two different interviews with Lindsay, and we've been checking in to find out how her pumpkins are growing. And Lindsay, you sent me a photo, and this was a couple of weeks ago. It's already gigantic. How's the season been?
Brian, the season has been awesome. It's been so much fun to watch my own pumpkin grow, as well as all the other pumpkins. They're huge.
What has made the season so good? Because we had hot weather, and then we had cold weather in July. It's just been, in fact, July was the first time in recorded history that was colder than June.
So you're right. The weather has been kind of a bummer because it's been so extreme. It's been either really hot or it's been pretty cold. It's been really weird. But as far as my pumpkin, it's been awesome just because I've already hit my personal best and beyond. So I have prepared my soil, and my soil is awesome. So for me in that area, it's been a great season. I think for others who have prepared their soil better and have really paid attention to that, their pumpkins have also gone beyond their personal bests. As far as the weather goes, you're right. It's been kind of crazy.
So what was your personal best before?
A huge 307 pounds.
Now, the Utah record is, I don't know, you better tell me. I know it's over 1,000 pounds.
Yes, the Utah state record is 1817.
So what do you think, for you anyway, what did you do different with your soil prep that has made the difference?
So this year I did a soil test, which I had been told previously I should have done, but I hadn't. But I sent out a test and got back all of the numbers, and I balanced my soil accordingly. And that really has made a huge difference.
What was your soil lacking?
My soil was lacking calcium. It was super high in nitrogen. And what else? I'm trying to think. I think I needed iron. I needed magnesium, manganese. On the UPG, the Utah Giant Pumpkin website, there's actually a chart that talks about the different percentages of everything you need in your soil to specific to pumpkin growing, and it'll tell you what percentages you need of everything. And I kind of matched my percentages to that chart.
Oh, great. And I know a basic soil test is very inexpensive, and they're done through the county extension offices, and it's usually like around $15 to get to the first three that you were mentioning, like the nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And then mm-hmm. you can pay a little bit more and get those specific things that you need to know, the micronutrients that you need to have in your soil. So you've seen success with that this year. So how big is your pumpkin right now?
My pumpkin is measuring, there are different charts out there, but on the chart that I'm using, it's measuring about 580 pounds.
Wow. So you're way beyond your personal best.
Yeah.
And you've still got how much in your growing season?
The way off is September 26th.
So you still have 6 weeks of growing left to add weight to your pumpkin.
I do. There is a growing curve with these pumpkins, so they'll put on the most weight between day 25 and 35 or mm-hmm. 40. So, and I'm past that big curve where I'm going to put on the most weight, but so I'm putting on just a little bit each day now instead of like the big gains, but it'll double from about day 40 by the end of the season. From the day you pollinate to day 40, if you take your measurements at day 40, they say at about the way off, it'll be about double that weight.
And where are you right now?
I think I'm day 60-ish.
What's your guess for how much yours is going to weigh if everything's perfect?
If everything's perfect, I'm hoping to just double my personal best. But I'm setting my expectations low, so I'll be excited and surprised and happy.
Because it sounds to me like you're going to go over 1,000, but, I've never grown a giant pumpkin before other than just throwing a couple of seeds in and not doing anything.
I won't go over 1,000. I wanted to, but I won't go over 1,000 because my growing curve, I pollinated super early, and so I'm way past my peak growing. I'm only gaining, maybe 10 pounds overnight now.
Well, what makes the difference then between one that's 800 pounds versus one that's 1,800 pounds? What do you think you could have done different or might try different next year?
I know a few things that I could have done. I didn't get my watering dialed in, so I didn't have consistent watering all the time. I didn't keep my plant cool enough. Right now I have my water set, so it waters for 45 seconds every 10 minutes from 11 to 4.
During the hottest part of the day.
So it keeps it cool and it keeps it consistently watered. I didn't have that set up until after I had my pumpkin. I think if my plant had been consistently getting that throughout the season, it would have helped.
Do you put any kind of a floating row cover to, do you want to cut any of the sunlight at all so it doesn't bake it too much, or do you want as much sunlight as you can get?
You want the length of sunlight. You want sunlight as long as you can have, but you do want a shade cover over the whole plant. So I have about 40% shade cover over the whole plant, but I don't get sun until about 1 o'clock. So that's another one of my problems.
Oh, so it doesn't get that.
Because I have a tree in my yard that blocks it until about 1.
And you haven't quite reached the point of obsession where you cut down your tree, right?
I'm so close. We cut off branches.
Yeah.
If I were to stay in this house long enough, I think I would have cut the tree by now.
No, I totally understand that with gardening, you get a certain obsession going and you just want to do the best you can. And it sounds like you're doing really well compared to last year, especially.
Yes. We had the patch tour on Saturday, and you won't believe this, but the guy, Matt McConkie, who has the state record, we went to his patch, and he had a 1,600-pound pumpkin already on
already?
Saturday.
Already? Oh, my heavens. So
yeah.
It sounds like the record's
so
going to get broken.
Who knows what
again.
That pumpkin could have been, but sadly, it had a little crack in it.
Just
so small. Not even an inch. Maybe an inch.
A crack where?
Perpendicular to the ribs. And that's really bad. So that pumpkin is taken down. And he just noticed it that day when we were at the patch tour.
How do the cracks form?
They just form, you know what, if the pumpkin grows too much, too fast, and it happens in so many different, it could have been anything. It could have been just more growth one night than the night before. It wasn't ready for it. The saying is, if you're not blowing them, you're not growing them.
If you're not blowing them, you're not growing them. So they're ballooning up, blowing up in size.
Right. If you're not cracking them, you're not growing them. You're not extreme. You're not.
Oh, okay.
It happens all of the time. It's sad, and it's the risk you take by, you know, feeding them and pushing them to the edge of trying to make them the biggest they can get.
So I would think that Utah might have some advantages because of the heat and the sun that we get. Is there another part of the country that actually is the mecca for growing giant pumpkins?
I know a lot of the people in California have a good advantage with the weather. It's more consistent in the high 70s or low 80s. But there's just different, pros and cons with different places. We don't deal with vine borers and, we just have different bugs. They have different bugs. We have different funguses. We have more dry weather. And so back east, they have really great cool, humid, but then they have more funguses that they have to deal with. So,
So maybe they
actually is harder here because it's so hot.
So they might have more successes, but they might have more failures as well.
Right. So with every place, there's the pros and cons, but here especially we have to deal with the heat, and that's a big con that we have to really watch and take care of.
So that's why you have your 40%. Shade cover, so it's letting in 60% of the light because it's so bright, and that keeps the heat down on the plant.
Mm-hmm. We have fans going. We have misters. People do water throughout the day, like I said, and it's hard to keep that temperature down during the days where it gets so hot.
Do you have thermometers that you check to see what the temperature is like and then make adjustments?
Yeah, Yeah, we have temperature. Yeah, we have thermometers. Some of us have apps on our phones. We can check our phone during the day to make sure that the temperature is right in our patch at home.
This is really hardcore, isn't it?
Someone had a camera. Well, not just someone, but a bunch of people have cameras on their patches at home so they can check and see who's been in their patch, what's happening in their patch when they're away.
Do they have, I know there are apps where you can check in and actually look in your house. I would imagine some of the pumpkin growers have that camera turned toward their garden.
Yes, for sure. A mommy cam.
They've got that baby out in the patch. You've got to keep an eye on it.
Is it? Yep, that's for sure. Some people have pictures of kids on their phone. Some of us, we just take pictures of our pumpkin.
Tell me when your next activity is.
Our next activity is the Way Off, September 26th.
And where will that be?
At Thanksgiving Point.
At Thanksgiving Point.
There is an additional Way Off. This is the first Way Off that we'll have at Hee Haw Farm. So we'll have two Way Offs this year. The one at Thanksgiving Point on the 26th, and then there's one at Hee Haw Farms in Pleasant Grove on October 10th. The regatta is on the 17th, and that's our boat race.
And so you carve the pumpkins and float down the river in them?
In the Sugar House Pond.
Okay.
And like I said, I don't know if that's for sure or if there is going to be a change on the location, but as for now, it's Sugar House Pond.
Now, tell me your website address.
It's Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers.
Okay. And I noticed at that site that there are some YouTube videos. One of them, I see pumpkins being dropped on a van. Then you also get to see the regatta and people floating in the pumpkins. So there's a lot of fun and interesting information that can be found at your website. And I encourage people to go there, especially if they have any interest in growing giant pumpkins. There's a lot of information.
Yes. And that drop is on the October 24th. It's on October 24th and it's at Hee Haw Farms as well.
Great. Well, I've been talking with Lindsay Bench. She's spokesperson for the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers. And again, the website is utahgiantpumpkin.org or .com?
.com.
Okay. Lindsay, thank you so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thanks for chatting.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and it's our Going Native segment where we recommend a drought-tolerant or native plant for your garden. And in studio with me is Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery in Joseph, just south of Richfield. And today it's the Bouteloa gracilis.
Yes, that's
or
right.
Or blue grama. And yes. I'm guessing this is a grass.
Yes, it's a bunch grass.
Okay. So what makes this one a great plant to include in your landscape?
Well, bunch grasses are really popular right now, and that's a good reason. They just add another dimension to the garden. Light and airy, and they are beautiful in the fall when everything else is starting to fade. The grasses really come into play, take center stage basically. And right now, all around Logan here, even around Logan, there's a lot of beautiful grasses starting to flower. And the flower is basically these seed heads, these seeds that it's starting to produce.
And I love that you have this down as dainty but tough.
It's so dainty. Its nickname is the eyelash grass because the seed heads look like eyelashes. Very, very cute. And even when they first come out and they're bright green in the summer, they still look gorgeous. But in the fall when that golden color, when they start to really take on the show, they're just gorgeous.
And how drought tolerant are these?
Really, 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 really drought tolerant.
Okay, yeah. So that's really drought tolerant.
Very drought tolerant. However, I see them on my hikes, and I'll see this grass growing, and what the heck is that? And I'll get down and look at it, and the seed stalk is about 2 inches tall, and it's blue grama. But in the garden with supplemental water, good, tame environment, they'll get 1.5 to 2 feet tall.
Wow. So smaller if you don't water it at all, and bigger but not ganglier or too much out of hand with
never,
extra water.
I've never seen it get ganglier out of hand.
Easily identified, you said, by the eyelash-shaped seed heads.
Mm-hmm.
It's a warm-season bunch grass.
And that means it grows when it's warm. A certain temperature, certain day length, then it starts to grow. And that's what makes it drought tolerant. Because if it started to grow when it was early spring and it didn't get the water from the rain, perhaps it wouldn't survive.
Average size, about 2 feet by 2 feet. Mm-hmm. I like this. Spreads by seeds or tiller?
Tillers are the little tiny roots that kind of...
Oh, okay. I'm thinking of me taking my tiller out and...
Well, you know what? It will spread by that tiller, too.
Okay, so it's by seeds or it sends out little... Yeah, those are called tillers?
They're just... It's not like a bluegrass, a Kentucky bluegrass that has those really long...
Not the rhizomes.
Right. It's just this little root, and the plant will gradually get bigger, and that's why it's a bunch grass. It just gradually
But it stays tidy.
It stays really tidy,
okay.
Yes.
Full sun, though,
mm-hmm.
for
yes.
most of these. Zones 3 through 7, so quite a range.
Very, yep.
Used for restoration. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay. After a fire... Or grazing, whatever they want to restore an area, they'll reseed it with this because it reseeds. It's hardy, it's tough, and it reseeds easily.
Okay. Stunning and xeriscape borders as a filler.
Right. If you've ever had a bouquet of flowers, right? Really, really pretty. But you've got these bare spots in this flower arrangement. So they'd stick in baby's breath, right? And this is kind of what I found in my garden that it does, in my xeriscape garden. It will come up between the penstemons and just fills it in very nicely.
Now, you bring up the term xeriscape, which I continually have to explain to people. It's not xeriscape, and which they think, okay, no water at all, and it's going to just look...
And zero means zero.
Yeah, and so...
This is Zera.
It's X-E-R-I. And what does that mean?
It means dry, basically dry or little whatever.
But it doesn't mean no.
It doesn't mean zero, huh?
Yeah. Fall the plant is wheat. Oh, in the fall, the plant is wheat-colored.
Right.
Okay, so it loses the green and goes a little more airy looking.
Right. And I've seen this. Red Butte Gardens has a really nice display. It's just a solid mass of this grass, and they don't cut it back. A lot of people will grow this as a turf, as a lawn grass, and they'll keep it mowed. And that's really, really attractive. Mm. But Red Butte has this area that on a little hillside, a little space that has nothing but this growing with those little eyelash seed grasses, seed heads. It's beautiful.
Sounds wonderful. Well, this is our grass that we're talking about, the Blue Grandma grass. It's our Going Native segment, and Jeanette Warner, owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph, has been my guest. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
This is the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. Some of the issues that you're seeing with tomatoes this year, curly top.
Yeah, we've seen quite a bit of curly top around.
Explain what that is.
It is earlier in the spring when the desert starts to dry off. There's a little insect called the beet leaf hopper, and the beet leaf hopper migrates off the desert as it starts to move up toward the mountains, and it flies in and it picks up this disease from other plants that don't show symptoms of the curly top. So a lot of weeds, a lot of desert plants have it. And so they take this disease with them. And as they move through the garden, they settle on our vegetables and they take a bite here and a bite there. And then they might move on again. And that one bite is enough to infect the plant. Now, certainly the more bites they take, the more infection you're going to get. And the plants that we've seen it in, I've seen it in pepper this year, tomato, cucumber, squash. Those tend to be the more common ones, but many of our plants will get the symptoms of it. You might see in a pepper, the plant doesn't have as many fruit on it. The plant is a little bit on the small side, and it got kind of a yellowish tone to it, a light yellow tone. Now in tomato, it's really pronounced because the plant turns really yellow. Mm-hmm. It stays really compact.
And the leaves
curl. It all twists up. And oftentimes the fruits stay very small and they start to ripen. And if you bite one of those fruits, they're really bitter. So we see it most in tomato, but I've seen it in squash this year. I've seen it in cucumber. I've seen it in peppers, and I've seen it in tomato.
Do you just pull up the plant?
That's the best thing to do. The reason you pull them up is because they're never going to produce anything for you, and then you don't ever have the desire to go and harvest it. And the problem comes when the symptoms aren't very strong, and then you get some of these fruits. And so some people say, well, you know, my cucumbers are kind of bitter. My explanation for that is there's a lot of reasons. If we have water stress in cucumber, you'll get bitterness in the fruit. If you have excessive heat, you'll get bitterness. If you have a little bit of curly top, you also get bitterness. And so it's really hard to say unless we go in and test for it and try to extract the organism that causes that disorder.
And I've got a good UPR friend that lives in the Roosevelt area, and he saw curly top a ton last year. And of course, what's directly to the south of them? Yeah. Lots of desert.
Yeah.
Lots of desert country.
And I had quite a few growers in the Salt Lake and Layton region that said that we've gone out and looked at their fields, you know, 10 to 15, maybe 20% of their plants. So if you had 5 acres of tomatoes and you have 20% of the plants have curly top in them, that's basically an acre of tomatoes that are impacted by this, scattered all over your farm. And so it's really not, those farmers know, I'm not going to go out and do anything. It's pretty hard to find leafhoppers in the garden at this time of the year. And you can't control the thing because I don't know when it's coming. And I don't know how long it's staying. And even if I do apply a pesticide to my plant, it just comes in and bites. It has to ingest the pesticide, so it's already transmitted the problem. And then it flies on and dies someplace else. Well, I haven't accomplished anything. So, you know, it's a really tough disease, and we don't see it every year in big numbers. This year, we just seem to see a little bit more of it. Normally, I think by the time the desert dries out, plants are, you know, sometimes are a little larger or a little smaller. So it kind of, it's really hard to predict when this is going to come in and give us a problem.
Are some varieties less susceptible than others?
No.
Oh,
so there is
okay.
No varietal resistance. There are some that they suggest that are more tolerant to it, but we've tested all those, and they have a big problem all the time in St. George. The growers down there have a really big problem with it. And so Rick Heffelbauer, our extension educator in Washington County, he and I talked at lengths, and he got a little bit of a grant to go study this, and he worked with some farmers down there, grew the plants, put them out in their farms, and he got curly top in all of those. He tried to use floating row covers over top of the plants when they were little, you know, like Remay or something, to keep the leafhoppers off them. Still gets it. You know, it helped some. They were less there because it's harder for the leafhopper to get underneath that cover. But he said, well, you know, just grow whatever you grow. Maybe grow some more plants if you've had a perpetual problem with it. And so instead of growing 20 plants in your garden, you grow 30 plants in your garden. And then if you get it, it's not a big problem. You have plenty of tomatoes. If you don't get it, you have lots of tomatoes. And, you know, you just help your neighbor out, bring them to the food bank or do something, you know, service-oriented. Bring them to church. That's what we have a thing at church where people that have more produce are not put it out on their table because we have some older people in church that they don't grow a garden anymore and they still like to eat this stuff. And so they can just take some home with them. So there's plenty of ways for you to get rid of this extra produce that you have in the garden.
It's the Zesty Garden. I have Dan Drost. He is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And right now we're going to talk about sweet corn. So lots of sweet corn is coming on. And one of my favorite vegetables, although not quite so much anymore, and then I found out that the body doesn't really absorb anything, but the sugars and the roughage, that's pretty much all it does for you. But, oh, it sure tastes good.
Well,
though.
You know, you sometimes in life, you know, you have to put a little bit of stuff in the mouth, and that maybe isn't that good for you, you know. So I don't mind an ice cream cone now and then, but the fat I
right.
probably don't need.
Yeah.
Right? So, I mean, you know, all things in moderation is as the good book says. And so corn is one of those things. You know, it's been a pretty good year for it, but some of the commercial farmers have said to me they've had two issues that have come up. May was excessively wet and cool, And so two problems happened. And so you may at times not see as much corn on the farm stands as you would like, because the growers during May would get in and plant a crop, and then they were supposed to come back in after a set number of days and plant their next planting, and then a set number of days and they plant the next planting, and that gives them, you know, kind of a uniform production so that they always have corn every week that can go to the marketplace. Well, they missed a couple of those plantings because it was too wet. We got some really heavy rains, if you remember May. Mm-hmm. Most of us have forgotten it by now, other than we say it was kind of wet in May. But, I mean, some places got 10 inches of rain in May, and that meant that the farmer couldn't plant because the fields were not accessible to the equipment to get it out in there. And so then if they did get it planted, because it was cool, the plants – two plantings are now similar to each other in their growth stages so that they get a big flush of corn. So you may see that, lots of corn. And then the next week it seems like it's kind of hard to farm as much corn. That's all due to May. Now, once they get into the last plantings of corn, generally in northern Utah here, are usually around the middle of June. So you're hoping that that extends your production out into September. We're seeing a little bit of issues with that. The growers were saying that they were having a little bit of difficulty with kind of corn not being ready, and therefore they're short, or two plantings that were ready at the same time, and now we've got too much. And the average customer doesn't see that, but I hear it, you know, and they're saying, well, what can we do about that? And I go, let's not get as much rain in May next year. And they all say the same thing. We'd rather be able to irrigate and put the water there when we want it rather than relying on Mother Nature to provide us with the moisture that it gives, even though that's beneficial to us. It makes their lives a little bit more challenging. The second issue that some of the growers have been complaining about is there's a lot of birds this year. And the birds come in, and what they do is they pick at the tip of the ear.
What types of birds?
Blackbirds, mostly. Huh. And
like red-winged blackbirds?
I don't know which one. They just say it's a blackbird. You know, there's a lot of blackbirds out there. And so I really need to figure out a little bit more. But what they do is they come in, and they scratch at the tip of the ear. They pull the silk back, and then they pick out a few of the kernels that are in there and then move on to the next one and do the same thing. And so it's a cosmetic issue that they really don't – the customer maybe wonders why there's – these peck marks that look like at the tips of the ear. And so that they were, you know, oh man, you know, how do we get rid of these stinking birds is really what they're
doing. And why are they this year worse than others? That's,
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they've never really complained about it, but this year I've heard a bunch of them complain about it. So that's kind of created a problem for
Question
them.
For Terry Messmer.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the other issue was that, you know, they said that, you know, those plants that were in tassel or in silk during that really hot weather that we had in early July, the ears aren't filled out nearly as much. So you would expect a ear that's maybe 9 or 10 inches long. They're a little shorter because they were being grown during that really, really hot period. And then some of the kernels that are in the ear didn't fill out because a silk maybe dried out before the pollen could germinate down each silk. So if you think about the anatomy of a corn plant, you got to have pollination that occurs over a set period of time when the silks are receptive to it, and you need to be shedding pollen from the tassel falling down onto the silk so that all of those kernels can fill. And if something goes wrong in there, then some kernels don't. And so I've noticed that when I've been purchasing some corn, because there's a couple guys in the valley that have sell corn on farm stands. And if I grow to a grower, of course, they always give me corn. But, you know, if I don't have it and Dawn says, let's have corn, and then I, you know, usually go buy it, I've noticed that there's more misses within the ear. And that was all due to that one hot weather. And now I would suspect that as it's been more mild, we're not going to see that problem in some of the later plantings unless we've had some really hot periods within you know, we might get some hot weather still in August here where it could impact it again. And the growers try to mitigate that to a certain extent by making sure that the plants are well watered and those kinds of things. But we're in a short water year, and they've been trying to save water and deal with some of those kinds of issues as well. And so we may see a little bit more of that. Other than that, they said corn earworm hasn't been a real big problem this year. We've been able to control it reasonably well. And most other corn-related problems just aren't really kind of impacting them in any real way.
If you planted some late corn in your garden, when's the last time you should give any fertilization to the plant?
I like to see some fertilizer put on just about the time you see the tassel pushing up through the center of the whorl.
So if you see it down in the middle.
Yeah, so and it's starting to elongate up, that's when you want to put some nitrogen on the plant. And then what happens with that is that helps put energy particularly into the ear leaf and make sure that you grow a big, long ear. And it also just makes sure that the plant has enough energy to be able to grow that ear out to size. And so that's usually the timing that the farmer tries to do. He looks and, oh, I've got some tassels that are forming. I'm going to make sure I get my last dose of fertilizer on so that that plant can suck it up and grow a nice ear that is long and filled out and like we would want.
How important is hilling corn?
Only if you have a problem with, you know, where you tend to be a little bit overwatering it and you could keep your soil a little bit wet and then you get a windstorm and then it falls over. Mm. That's what usually causes it. Now, if you think about what's going on down in near the soil, you get those big brace roots that form. They come out of the stalk above the soil level and grow out. Those are like buttress roots. They help to hold the plant up. But if we keep our garden really wet and then we get a big windstorm, then, you know, sometimes corn will lodge regardless of what we do.
It's one of those ideas that popped into my head is, why do I hill the corn? That's because I've just always done that.
Yeah.
And do I need to do that?
It's not really necessary.
Can I save myself some work?
You can save yourself some work. It doesn't hurt any. But it's
it looks nice once I've gone and done it.
Well, and we do it as we're, you know, kind of weeding and doing some other things when you get that last effort done, when the corn is maybe knee high or thereabouts, and you just kind of work through, get the last of the weeds, and then you don't have to think about it and worry about it because the corn is big enough that the weeds aren't going to interfere with the production of the plant.
Hmm. Okay. Well, that answers a few questions about corn. What about beans?
I think some of the problems that we had comes back to our heat again, and I talked a little bit earlier about how pod set occurs when it's normally you'll get a straight pod and all the little seeds that are in that pod will form, and that creates the straightness, and it also makes it fill out nice and so that it's uniform in diameter all the way down it. But that heat causes us some problems. Right now, the last couple weeks, the weather has actually been pretty good, and the bean crop looks fantastic, though I did have a few people that have said to me they expected more early beans. I also got someone that sent me an email and said I had all these little white spots on my beans, and I couldn't figure it out. And I said, well, you know, usually the thing that causes white spots are we have either ligus bug or we have bean weevils or something like that that come in, and they are tend to take a poke their snouts into the pod and eat a little bit, and then they move on, and that creates a tiny hole that it bleaches out around there because they've sucked the juices out. And in fact, when he went back and they looked more closely at him, they could kind of see him from a distance, but when they looked really close, they go, oh yeah, there was a little hole there. So it was probably ligus bug or one of the weevils that was feeding on the pods. It probably isn't bean beetle because usually bean beetles don't feed so much on the pods. They just eat the leaves and skeletalize the things. I never worry about bean beetle. I have seen a few ligus bugs around, and I've seen some weevils around, and so it was probably that. And he goes, Yep, that's I saw the little hole, so I don't know which one it is right now, but both of them have similar types of appearances. And if I had a sample, I could look more closely. I could probably figure out which one.
What causes a stippling or a rippling in the leaf? I'll look at my beans as they're maturing and climbing up,
yep.
And they'll look fine, but then there's this one section where it looks like all the leaves are kind of crinkled and
yeah, you might
like
go,
there's some kind of a pathogen in the soil.
Well, it could be. There are, you know, some like verticillium and fusarium wilts. There are some of the bean wilts that occur, and so they may have a little bit of that. Also, look under the leaf and see if you see any mites, because spider mite and some
will
of those
cause that
will
happen.
Cause that to happen too. They cause the leaf to either curl a little, not to expand out as much, to have a little bit discoloration to it.
If the leaf just seems to be smaller.
Yeah.
It stays and, mostly open, but just...
And there are some viral diseases and other fungal diseases. Usually the fungal diseases aren't happening, but the plant might have a virus or
it's
something.
It's time
like
to
that.
Move them. I usually keep them in one area yeah. for 2 to 3 years and then move them to another section. So
yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, we'd have to pull up a few plants and yeah. look at them, but those are some ideas that come to mind.
Anything else?
No, I think beans overall have been pretty good, and you know, it's been a reasonably good year for them. The growth has been nice, and the beans that I've gotten out of the work that we've been doing have been quite tasty. And so, yeah, not too much on beans. I think the final thing I would like us to talk about is a little bit, you know, we're getting into watermelon and cantaloupe mm-hmm, season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think most people have a hard time figuring out when to harvest these crops. And so the cantaloupes, as I said in the past, have always been the relatively easy. So it's just a reminder to our listeners is that if you see the stem where the stem attaches to the fruit on a cantaloupe, if you start seeing cracking around that stem, then that fruit is ripe. And if you want it to have the full amount of sugar, you know, wait for that crack to go 360 degrees around where
it attaches. In other words, if you lift it up and it comes right off.
And it just pops right off. Then yeah. it's super ripe, so eat it right away. You know, just I would cut it out of the peel. I put it in a bowl, and then it goes in the refrigerator, and it sits there for a couple days, and then it's really, really sweet and tasty. If you are doing watermelons, you don't have that option. So the couple things that you need to look for in watermelons are you look at where it's laying on the soil. We call that the ground spot. So you roll the melon over. If the ground spot looks yellowish or creamy in color rather than white, that's closer to maturity. The second thing you look for is if it's a striped melon, you look for contrast between the stripes. So the lighter stripe should go from a greenish color to a more white type color. And so there'll be strong contrast between those, white and green. And then the third thing you look for is just opposite where the stem of the melon attaches to the vine, there's a little modified leaf that we call the tendril. And that tendril should be dry all the way to the vine.
Looks like a little curly-cue pig's
yeah,
tail.
Yeah, pigtail type thing. Part of it is curled and part of it is not. The curled part is the leaf part. The not curled part is the stem part. So it's a modified leaf. It's not really any other thing than that. It should be dried out. And if you have those three things going for you, then you're going to get, you can harvest the melon. And then when you cut it, you know, the first one usually you're not maybe do such a good job on, and then you can kind of work from there. Tapping it, thumping it, kicking it, rolling it, listening to it, feeling it, all of those things are not good indicators of maturity. Because at the time of the day, if you thump it in the morning, it's more hydrated. It sounds different than if you thump it in the afternoon when it's less hydrated. Because water is moving around the plants, and the plants actually take water out of the fruit during the day as it gets hot and use that. And at night, they pump water back into the fruit. And so, you know, the sound is different, doesn't work. So don't bother trying that. I see people thumping all the time in the grocery store, and I just kind of go, okay, whatever. If you think that's going to work for you.
Well, that's because they've seen someone else thumping.
Well,
it must
in the grocery store, 9 times out of 10, the farmer that has harvested knows exactly what he's looking for, and all of them are very close to ripe. So it's pretty unusual to get a pink one when you're in the grocery store. So.
And the best time to pick would be in the morning then.
Well, from a sugar perspective, actually, the best time to pick is in the evening.
And so why? Why is that?
Well, two reasons. In the morning, remember, it hydrates overnight, so it pushes water in. And if I put a teaspoon of water in a teaspoon of sugar in a gallon of water, or if I put a teaspoon of sugar in a quart of water, which one tastes sweeter? In the quart, right? Mm. So what happens during the day is it's sucking water out, but it doesn't suck the sugar out.
So it's concentrating.
So it concentrates it. So actually, in the afternoon,
it tastes
a little sweeter. So I tend to harvest more later in the afternoon. You know, if I want fruits that have a little bit higher sugar content.
Does that hold true across the garden for a lot of above ground vegetables?
Well, certainly for the ones that we're interested in the sugar in. So, you know, cantaloupes and honeydews and those kinds of melons and watermelon, of course. I don't think it makes – I haven't done it for tomatoes or peppers because there's sugars in those as well. You know, it's something that we should try sometime is just, you know, go through and profile them. It's a little harder with – we could do it with tomato because it's easy to tell when they're ripe. With red peppers, we could probably do it, you know, easy enough because red peppers are actually sweeter than green peppers. We know that. But if you were picking greens or something like that, it might be a little bit more difficult because it's actually stage of development actually will have an impact on sugar content.
I wanted to skip back to the watermelon. Why does that tendril, what does it serve the plant having that little curlicue opposite the stem?
Some say that it has a lot to do with in wild types have much longer tendrils to them, and it was designed that because they're a prostrate plant, they're laying on the soil surface and they grow out there, that essentially in order to, rather than have other plants overgrow them and shade them, the modified leaf wraps around things and it allows it to climb up. So climbing beans either have nycnastic movement, though they twist around things, or they, like peas, have tendrils so that they can attach themselves to other things and keep themselves up so that they stay up and get the maximum amount of sunlight. They often say that that's what the genetic or the evolutionary tactic is, a holdover to allow them to crawl on vines and bushes. Now, the watermelon is native to the Kalahari Desert in southern Africa, and so it grows in areas that it has some shrubs there. So by growing up on these things, it helps them keep their leaves up where the sun is greatest so that the fruit can mature and so that the seeds can be developed in
it
as well.
So it's kind of like the human tailbone of of the cucurbit family.
Yeah, you, might think of it that way.
Doesn't serve much. No, there's a little bit there, but doesn't serve much purpose.
Yeah, it doesn't serve much purpose anymore.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming
in. Pleasure
coming
in again.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we'll have him back in again.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams. I'm going to talk about beauty today because for me, gardens are always about beauty. It's wonderful that they have other things to recommend them, but I have an artist's soul, and the beauty, even in a vegetable garden, is very, very important and nourishes me. So today, I'm going to share with you the chapter called Beauty Counts, or something, a reading from that chapter, from, as you know, one of my favorite books, Gardening at the Dragon's Gate by Wendy Johnson, who's also a fool for beauty. I'm going to start it with a little reading, a little narrative by Alan Chadwick, who also lived at Green Gulch in California when she was a gardener there. And he writes, "In the days when humans lived in balance, they were watched over and guided by the stars. And at a certain period, it was observed that people were beginning to over-rely on their reason and intellect. Therefore, two stars were ordered to descend to Earth to enlighten humankind. It so happened that those two stars arrived on Earth at the very moment that the archangel raised his sword and drove Adam and Eve out of the garden, and these two stars attempted to follow in the endeavor to fulfill their orders. But the archangel raised his sword and said, "None may follow these two where they must travel in the land of darkness." And the one star raised a medallion and said, "I represent the king of fishes and am strength." And the other star raised a medallion and said, "I am the queen of crops and I represent comfort." And when the archangel recognized his two siblings, he lowered his sword and permitted them to pass in the form of two herbs, rosemary for strength and lavender for comfort. In this form, they traveled beside Adam and Eve throughout all the lands of darkness, showing them always, when they required it, the paths that led back to where they had come from. So, from Beauty Counts. Years ago, when Harry Roberts first began to work with us at Green Gulch and to teach us what he knew, we were sitting with him on a Sunday afternoon in late summer, shelling our first crop of English peas over in a shady corner of the garden. "Before you do anything, anything at all," Harry suddenly announced to us in the midst of our green reverie, "make sure that you have three good reasons for doing what you do." I looked up at my grizzly old teacher perched on his camp stool, unzipping his pea pod with pristine care and attention. It was quiet in the garden but for a round plink of peas falling into our warm metal bowls. "That goes for setting up a garden, too," Harry cast down to me, eyeing me intently before picking up his next pea. I sat there in the filtered sunlight, staring into my bowl of iridescent peas. They shone from the inside out, luminous gems chipped from the deep green mines of August. "What about beauty?" I asked Harry. "Is beauty a reason?" "Beauty?" he queried, hovering over his mounded bowl of summer peas. There was a long pause. "Beauty counts," he finally proclaimed, letting loose a rain of peas. I am a garden dreamer, but a practical one, rooted in working the garden and the ground and sustained by pushing wheelbarrows full of growing plants. The garden will never be a metaphor for me, but always an actual place of danger and wanton beauty. When I walk into a garden, I step into paradise with an address, paradise located on earth. This is just as true in an abandoned city garden with a chain-link fence ripped down and all the forgotten crops running to seed in a wild jumble of sun-gold tomatoes and old collard greens, as it is in a plump, well-tended country estate garden fat with sumptuous figs and overripe white melons. I love the word paradise, rich in meaning and association. It comes from the old Persian paradesa, or a walled enclosure, and by horticulture extension, an enclosed garden. In biblical and classical literature, paradise is found on earth in the original Garden of Eden, where four great rivers meet, and in the celestial heavens where the blessed dead gather together for the final resurrection. Curiously, in the biblical Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve do not really begin to garden until they disobey God, eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and are expelled from the protection of Eden. Sent out into that wild and untamed world beyond the gates of enclosed paradise, man and woman toil by the sweat of their brow to garden a new worldly paradise on earth. According to one of Alan Chadwick's favorite parables, Adam and Eve had two companions when they were forced to leave paradise because of their over-reliance on reason and intellect and their refusal to obey God. On their journey out and east of Eden, he said, Adam and Eve were accompanied by two archangels in the forms of plants. Rosemary for strength and lavender for comfort protected them on their journey and reminded them always of the way home to the garden. When you design and plant a garden, mystery and magic manifest in the rich brocade robe of plants that you lay out on the earth of paradise. I planted rosemary and lavender just inside the garden gates at Green Gulch to welcome visitors to the Zen Center. Long borders of English lavender with formal plantings of Tuscan rosemary standing behind them flank the main road leading through Green Gulch and out to the sea. Bumblebees fumble in the lavender flowers, gathering pungent nectar from the queen of crops, and turn slow somersaults in the thick sea of lavender perfume. When guests enter the summer garden, the old spell of lavender brings them to a silent standstill. In the first years of farming and gardening at Green Gulch, I dreamed of creating a self-sustaining garden that would buffer Zen practitioners from the busyness of everyday life. We would only eat what we grew on our own pure land and only use materials generated from our local bioregion to build and sustain the new farm and garden. I was mightily righteous in my notions of seceding, untainted, from the marketplace of society. Over the years, I have shifted my stance. Instead of retreating from the world, I advanced, falling in love with it as it radiated out in widening circles from the core of the garden. Nowadays, I am called to help establish tiny plots of paradise in local schools, hospitals, prisons, and abandoned city lots throughout the wider Bay Area. Sometimes I wish that these urban gardens were a little more Eden-esque and a tad less demanding, but this doesn't seem to be in my horticultural cards. Perhaps I love the garden most for this combination of engagement with the world's needs and those long hours when I find myself alone in paradise in the cool of the day. The evening light is slanted and pale green, and wind moves through the gaps in the dark rosemary hedge like blue smoke over the uncut lavender. Ask me then for three good reasons to garden, and I will tell you: for beauty, for the coming apart of beauty, and for the opportunity to begin again with no design in mind. Thanks for being with me. I'm Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.